both psychology and spirituality. And the fit with what Jess was trying to put together in terms of a song path, as this being a journey, really, of helping people journey through nature to come into better relationship also with themselves. That being a spiritual journey, that being a musical journey, but also being a psychological journey.
Rufus Harrington is the consultant cognitive behavioural psychotherapist for Songpath and has worked closely with us in cultivating our therapeutic walking trails and general practice. He is the director of cognitive behavioural therapy studies at the University of Cumbria. He's also a specialist in hermetic meditation, a Western tradition of meditative practice, and the director of the newly founded Wiser Mind Institute, teaching a psychology of integration.
If you're looking at the kind of hallmarks of mental health, an ability to be flexible, to adapt to circumstance, engage with possibility, all of that's another way of describing creativity. It's another way of describing growth. The only way you grow is to engage in some ways with what you don't know. The only way you learn is by doing something new and having a willingness to fail a bit on the line.
I'm Jess Dandy, and this is Podpath, the Songpath podcast, where conversations about mental health allow us to explore ways of connecting creatively and restoratively to ourselves, each other, and the world around us. Today's episode is the first of two documenting a wonderfully rich and far-reaching conversation with Rufus Harrington. Welcome, Rufus, to our first episode of the Songpath podcast. Maybe you could start with telling us a little bit about your involvement in the Songpath initiative, what you've already done with us on our physical Songpaths, and what the therapeutic basis for a song path is?
Well, it all started with being mugged by Jess. Basically, it's all her fault. Jess knew me, knew of my interests and my work within both psychology and spirituality. And the fit with what Jess was trying to put together in terms of a song path, as this being a journey, really, of helping people journey through nature to come into better relationship also with themselves, that being a spiritual journey, that being a musical journey, but also being a psychological journey. And I think as we talked about this, Jess, it became more and more obvious that that sort of integration of music, psychology, spirituality, that the song path in a way is about learning to walk a more meaningful life and to embody that both in a place, on a day, to go through an experience of going through the real song path process, but also that underpinning that is a vision, really, of human beings just living in a better way, you know, deeper, more connected. And in a way, I bring, I think, to the project the insights of modern psychology, because I'm very much an evidence-based, dyed-in-the-wool cognitive behavioral therapist. But I was also trained in spiritual systems of meditation from a very young age. And to my mind, the two things actually complement each other beautifully.
That's great. And you've mentioned the word embody. And I think that's something that we really explore at Songpath. It's this idea that together we bring our bodies on the journey and we have a conversation with our landscape. And in so doing, our bodies actually acquire a sense of definition in relation to the landscape. And I wonder whether you could talk about the notion of the connection to body and its therapeutic benefits within the field of modern psychology.
Well, the magic word is integration. To see mind and body as two things separate is a hugely bad mistake to make. You know, the human mind, the human psyche, the body are deeply all part of the same system. And you know, at a very, very simple level, if you've consumed vast quantities of alcohol, you will know that it has a wonderfully impactful mood-changing effect, shall we say, on your mind. And mind and body, they are brother and sister. They are all part of the same system. And what we're doing on Songpath is acknowledging that in a very practical way. From the spiritual philosophies, there's a lovely saying, as above, so below, which is very much pointing to the fact that the higher mental faculties, the physical faculties, all of these things are deeply, deeply woven together, all part of the same experience. And so when we walk the song path, we're walking the song path, but at the same time, directing our attention to be aware of mind and body, the path that we're walking along, to develop a mindful relationship with the environment we're walking through, the physicality of earth, the path that we're walking on, but also that physicality of body, of actually being alive. Noticing is the daft thing. Most people are sort of existing, pottering through life because they're busy paying the bills, that kind of thing. But there's nothing wrong with that. But some of our best moments in life is when we open our awareness and experience what we're doing and actually become embodied in the moment, in the here, in the now that we are living. And Songpath's about getting into that state, I think.
Absolutely, and I think we've talked a lot about this feeling of connectivity and the way in which it is an antidote to the disconnection of mental health conditions. And I wonder whether you could talk a little bit, you've referred to people maybe going through life in a way that is existing, but maybe you could go a little bit further and talk about how mental health conditions are generally characterized by disconnection and how that manifests itself in neuroscientific terms.
Yeah, this is fundamental. If you look at mental health disorders, they are all of them really different forms of disassociation. And what I mean by that is a disconnection from a part of your experience. You know, if you take a typical case of somebody who's been traumatized, somebody who's been through a horrible traumatic experience in their past or something more recent, typically that sets up a set of horrible feelings, memories that a person may not want to remember, to face. And so one way or another, they find a way to disconnect from that experience, which can be protective. It can help you in the short term to cope with that situation. And it's a natural thing we do as human beings. But the problem is, if you get stuck in that mode, if you have to disconnect from what you're emotionally feeling, what your memory is trying to present to you, if you've got to get away from feelings in your body of anxiety that you really find difficult to cope with, more and more you start living in a way to avoid any feelings being set off. You live in a way where you avoid different memories by distracting yourselves in different ways. You know, some memory or feeling comes to mind, and you've just got to turn away from it. And what happens over time, you turn away from the experience of being alive. You end up in this very sort of what I call uncomfortably numb state, plagued by sort of spikes of anxiety which intrude, which you're then always fighting with. And increasingly, a person ends up fighting with themselves, their life energy being spent on avoiding their own experience. And the bottom line of it, it's terribly exhausting on the one hand, and typically people who have anxiety disorders become anxious, become exhausted, and that exhaustion really is the depression that they then start mostly having, that they've literally exhausted themselves trying to get away from themselves. And if somebody's trapped in that kind of cycle, it's very hard to get on with living a meaningful life. And when I look at therapy, really, it's a game of two halves. On the one hand, tame the symptoms, help the person reconnect, deal with the things that they're avoiding. And once you've done that, the second half of therapy, which is in fact the more important bit, get on with living. In a way, get back on the song path. That's where we have to go. And so this notion of dissociation is right at the heart of any kind of psychological process. Really, psychotherapy is about integration, helping people to reconnect from themselves and to heal the wounds that perhaps traumas in their past have inflicted on them.
And so if somebody were to say, OK, this is all very well, I love the idea of this.
Yeah.
What would their first step be? Because one thing that is lovely about Songpath is that it can take the form of a huge collective walk, as we saw last year. But if somebody maybe doesn't feel up to that, how might, in the comfort of your own home, and this is particularly topical at the moment, we're all being forced to look far closer to home for our own sense of connection and integration. So how might somebody create their own mini song path?
I work with a lot of clients online now. And so in a sense, I have a window into their homes where they are dealing with the COVID-19 situation. And one thing that's coming across in that work is that people have had a chance to slow down. People have had a chance to kind of actually take a pause. Now, it's not true for everybody. Some people are in very difficult situations. But for those in relatively okay circumstances, they've taken a pause. And instead of their attention being locked on work, getting up, get into work, get through the day, come home, sort the house out, feed the kids, there's a little bit more space and time. And the interesting thing is, once you've got a bit of space and time and your attention is no longer locked into that kind of a routine, you start moving into a state of mind more suitable for building a song path. Because a song path, in a way, starts with, in a sense, a simple question. Well, who am I? What do I want? Who do I want to be? What do I want to do? And that question so often gets lost in the chaos of just getting through the day and doing what you've got to do. And so to just pause to begin with and begin to just, those kind of dreams that perhaps you put aside because you're busy, to begin to just ponder. It's a little bit like when you're on holiday, you've been there for about a week, you've sunned, you've relaxed, and suddenly all those wonderful things you'd like to do start coming to mind. That is the beginning of the song path. And instead of ignoring those ideas, the start point's to begin playing with those ideas, actually listen to them. You know, get the pad of paper out, write about them, let the crazy thoughts come to mind. Begin to explore those urges, sensations, those dreams, fantasies, ideas that you would like to explore some more. So that's the start point. And once you've got that start point, it's the golden thread to follow, if you like, the golden thread of the song path, is instead of ignoring all that stuff, it's begin to follow that stuff and begin to unpack it a little bit. And, you know, in practical terms, here, stuck in lockdown, it might be getting out Mr. Google and going to explore those particular kinds of things that you're interested in. I've got a client at the moment and he was stuck at home, bored out of his mind. And he suddenly discovered he's got two things he's always wanted to get into: blacksmithing and glass blowing.
Brilliant.
You know, and this is a guy, you know, he spent a lot of time just doing all the normal stuff you do every day. But these are the two things. Ever since a kid, those things have been lurking at the back of his mind. And so what we're doing now, he's actually doing an online course studying this, laying the foundations to actually get into it. And he's ordering bits of kit to do a bit at home. And, you know, for him, this is opening up a world that he's always wanted to get involved in, but never placed his attention in that kind of space where some part of him wanted to go. And just having the lockdown, out of sheer boredom to start with, and, you know, a little bit of guidance from myself to sort of pay attention and to open his awareness in a different way. And he's loving it. it's suddenly bringing meaning into his life, and he's pursuing his path. I didn't have the slightest idea this guy would like to discover blacksmithing. You know, it's wonderfully bonkers, isn't it? It's brilliant. But in lockdown, he's discovered it and getting on with it, which is amazing. So it can be as simple as stopping to listen, pay attention to your dreams, and then start following your dreams.
Yeah, I think this notion of listening is a really lovely one, isn't it? Because we so often feel that in our immediate surroundings and in our lives that we have to sort of project some kind of preordained plan onto those surroundings. And actually the act of listening to our deep selves, or even just listening to the landscape around us, there will be some sort of answer there, and that we almost sort of become attuned to ourselves, attuned to some kind of deep message. And I think what you say also about the golden thread is a lovely one. In Greek mythology, anything that is blessed is a woven object. And I suppose what I'm saying is that by following the thread, you won't be left with a single thread, that things will actually start to interweave with that thread. And that giving yourself space to allow for that inevitable interweaving is a lovely thing. That deep listening to yourself is not an assurance that you will remain alone on your song path, that there will be these threads that will start to converge with your own thread in unlikely and unexpected ways. And that sort of very complex tapestry of life, and a life that is led with an open and kind curiosity to all possibilities in life, the possibilities of becoming a glass blower, or a furniture maker, or even an opera singer, are actually possibilities that don't keep you alone. They open you up to a complex web of what it actually means to be alive. And as you said, with this idea of as above, so below, it's been so wonderful. We mentioned in conversation a very long time ago the idea of the connectome project that is being done within neuroscience. And I would encourage everybody to look at those amazing images of the brain, which frankly look like a terrible mess. There are so many different networks and neurons that are all intersecting. Part of your work, Rufus, and part of our work is to actually embrace the connectivity of life, which actually can look really messy at times. And I think that we've discussed that a lot, this idea of coming to terms with uncertainty, coming to terms with things that look unwieldy, the idea of misguidedly thinking that good mental health is having a sense of tight control over all areas of life, and life is very tidy and very ordered, and don't come near me because I am hermetically sealed in my own hyper-competence.
Absolutely.
And I wonder whether you might talk about that idea of embracing the mess and the chaos of life, which maybe seems chaotic, but actually is appropriate to life and reflects the way that our brains love to work and thrive on working.
It's so fundamental, because engagement with the mess in some ways is the opposite of dissociation. Because when you're fighting all your feelings, when you're fighting memories, feelings in your body, emotions you don't like, you get into control in a big way. You know, you control what you do, because that will make a difference to what gets triggered off. You control your body, you control your feelings, you control your memory, you control what you're thinking. You try to not have experience. And the problem with that, that basically just creates anxiety and depression. Straightforwardly, it looks like you're doing something to make yourself feel more in control. The irony is it just makes you feel worse and worse and worse over time. And when we look, you know, at the actual sort of science behind a lot of our understanding of anxiety, right in the middle of that is what we call an intolerance of uncertainty. Very often people have perhaps been brought up in situations where there was a lot of uncertainty, and the way they coped with all that sort of difficulty was to then get into being perfectionists who had to control everything to feel safer. There was a reason for it. But the problem with living, you can't control all of life. You know, the reality of life is we can have some control, but whether we like it or not, life happens, stuff happens. COVID-19 is the perfect example. You know, here we are in a world where we would never imagine this would have happened, but it has. And we have to learn to change, to adapt, to work with the possibilities of this new situation. And when a therapist is working with a patient in any kind of situation, really, they are working to help the patient engage with uncertainty and transform it really into sort of looking at uncertainty in a different way, looking at uncertainty actually as possibility, that there are different opportunities. And if you're looking at the kind of hallmarks of mental health, an ability to be flexible, to adapt to circumstance, engage with possibility, all of that's another way of describing creativity. It's another way of describing growth. The only way you grow is to engage in some ways with what you don't know. The only way you learn is by doing something new. You've got to learn to play, grow, learn, be flexible. That's the good stuff. All that fear of change and uncertainty is what keeps you in the prison cell of sort of symptoms of anxiety and depression.
I really identify with that notion of possibility, and this idea that actually we can transform the received definitions of words. So this idea of uncertainty being a bad thing, or complexity being a bad thing, or knowing your place being a bad thing, you know, and actually this idea of possibility is something that we really ran with at Songpath. This idea that there's a wonderful book by Stephen Graham called The Gentle Art of Tramping, in which he sort of extols the virtues of walking in a creative way, bringing the imaginary, or the imaginal, as some people refer to it, back into the realm of reality, not being fixated on preconceived notions of approaching the world. And he talks in terms of when you walk through a valley or you lie prone on a hill, the door, which does not look like a door, opens. And I think this idea of spatializing our notion of reality, of actually seeing the world in terms of doorways or gateways or windows into other possibilities, it brings me to another area of your interest, which is the Hermetic tradition of Western meditation.
There is actually a very long history of a particular style of meditation taught in the West, which has nicked and borrowed from all sorts of places, including the East. And I've no doubt that over huge periods of time, there's been a wonderful interchange of ideas between East and West. And if you look at the deeper sides of the Eastern systems of meditation, you'll find they're not that different to some of the Western forms. But people tend to only get taught small parts of the Eastern system. Now, the funny thing, this point you make about opening doors, and if there's one thing that psychology, spirituality, the song path all have in common, it's about increasing awareness. And if you increase awareness, you're in a way opening a door between what you can see now and seeing something new, seeing something different. And what we know from psychology is that in a way we live locked into where our attention is focused. And one of the things I love is the modern sort of neuroscience around the human brain as a predicting machine. And that kind of makes sense from a survival point of view. Our greatest survival skill is trying to predict what will happen next. But the problem is our predicting brain tends to rely very heavily on what we've experienced in the past. So, you know, for example, in the past, as a kid, you get bitten by a scary dog. As you're then walking down the street and you see a dog, your brain throws up a prediction, dog is dangerous, and you have a panic attack. You have a phobic response and you run like hell in the opposite direction. Now, that's a good thing. It will keep you alive in the presence of scary, bitey dogs. Great stuff. But it will prevent you from going, hang on a minute, that's a nice dog. That's a cute puppy. I could train that dog. It might be able to go and hunt for me and do good stuff for me. It'd be a lovely pet and a companion. And what it looks like happened in the last 2 million years, we've developed a very different prefrontal cortex that is able not only to consider learning from the past, but it's able much better to consider experience in the present. It's the bit where we can, with practice, choose to focus our attention at will, not only on what's happened behind us in our past, but can focus very much more on our experience in the present. And harnessing that wonderful prefrontal cortex is really a lot of what we learn when we learn meditation. We learn to move our awareness, not only be a slave to our past, but embrace the experience that we're actually having in the present as well. And one of the lovely things, you go and walk the song path, you've got a chance to open your awareness, move your attention around, and start looking at new stuff and not be just stuck in the old stuff. Going to back to the holiday when you're lying on the beach, you kind of get out of the automatic pilot, living on the habits you've developed through life. And as you just lie there on the beach, chilling and relaxing, your brain starts actually moving in different directions. Now, that very common experience people have on holiday is what you deliberately cultivate actually through meditation. You cultivate the ability to deliberately move your attention about. In some ways, it's no more mysterious than that. It's about learning to be able to actually change the focus of your attention. And this is hugely important in psychology, because one of the great maintainers of psychological disorder is only ever focusing on what you've done wrong, reliving in your mind over and over again, every conversation you wear, you think you said the wrong thing, everything that you think you've done disastrously, and not paying attention to the fact that most days you get huge amounts of things right. Every day you're coping with problems, having small successes, having positive interactions with other people with a bit of luck. But the problem is, and the great tragedy of life, is people don't notice this because their attention is focused too much onto problems, what they've done wrong. And through meditation, through psychological therapy, through walking the song path, you learn to begin deliberately focusing your attention in different ways.
And I think what you say about learning is a very important thing, that actually we're very well practiced. These pathways are very well trodden of self-flagellation, of evaluating things in a negative way. And your cognitive behavioral therapy and your meditation are practice tools. They emphasize repeated actions or exercises that actually forge these new pathways. Because essentially, if somebody wants to instantaneously stop thinking negatively about something, it's not going to work, is it? It's this idea of cultivating something to such an extent that you have a sense of learnt spontaneity with it, to sort of borrow the Confucian phrase, this idea that these are habits, these are practices, these are disciplines that will take time to cultivate and work to cultivate. This attentional redirection is something that cannot be achieved with the flick of a wand. And also, when we talk about your meditative practices, one aspect of that is to think elementally about the world. And we've talked a lot about attentional redirection within Songpath and the idea of possibility, allowing the mind to wander, thinking in a more expanded, positive, curious way. But one thing that I suppose we haven't really talked about, which is central to Songpath, and I know is central to how you operate as well, is this idea of allowing nature to be our teacher, allowing us to reform a connection to nature and think elementally about the world. So, for example, within the Hermetic Western tradition of meditation, you use the four elements. You bring back a sense of deep-rootedness and you distill the world into its purest forms of earth, air, water and fire. And sometimes the people who practice that meditation can even use those allegorically for life. And I suppose we take this idea that we engage very materially with the world. We see a tree, we smell the ocean, but then actually we can begin to play with that, like you've said about this idea of allowing the mind to wander, allowing ourselves to play. And we can almost use that metaphorically within our own lives. We can kind of dissolve the boundary between our own bodies and the world around us, and we can see ourselves as forming part of a whole and connect more, not just in a sort of anthropocentric way, but in, to steal a term from Adam Nicholson, an ecozoic way, an idea that actually we see everything around us as equal partners in living. And that we can have beautiful relationships and conversations with trees and plants and flowers and the sea, or even Rufus Harrington via blue jeans. there's no kind of differentiation, and people don't need to feel isolated, even if there aren't that many people around, because there are doorways and possibilities in the most unlikely places.
A few of the words you used there about relationships, connectedness, the elements. If you look at what all meditation systems are trying to achieve, it is connection. Connection with self and the universe of which we're a part. There's lovely old parts from the Hermetic texts. There's a body of Hermetic texts called the Corpus Hermeticum. And there's a lovely piece in the Corpus Hermeticum that, to paraphrase it slightly, it's that if you can imagine within yourself all times, all places, that you are both young and old, if you can imagine that you are all these things, earth and water and air and fire, then you will truly come to an experience of the divine. That it's by opening yourself to experience, in a way, everything, that you actually become, you grow, you develop a deeper sense of connection to both yourself and the rest of the universe. And if you look at the sort of the techniques of meditation that have been passed down to us, they are specific technologies developed to help people make connection. And the point you make that you can't just sort of swish a wand and magically it all happens in 5 seconds is quite right. Because in order to develop the kind of awareness that is actually healthier, you've got to practice that awareness. It's no different from any other skill in life. If you want to learn to drive a car, you've got to take the lessons, practice the skills until it becomes automatic. And meditation is really just learning a set of skills to control and move attention in specific ways. Now, the beautiful thing is that when people wanted to connect to the world and they looked around them, they saw nature in all its beauty, and to teach ways to connect to that, they said, okay, let's look at the world. What's it made of? And some of the obvious stuff that it was made of was like the air you breathe, the fire, the warmth of life, the waters of the oceans, and of course, the sheer physicality of earth, tree, mountain. And so symbolic representations of that world were designed into meditation systems. And so in the Hermetic system, for example, you're taught to build a temple within your own psyche. And when I say temple, that is a place to go to build connections to the elements of earth and air and fire and water. In doing so, connecting to those basic experiences of human life, and by learning specific techniques, you can foster that ability that when you are in your life and living, you naturally connect into that experience of living. And it takes practice. And the curious thing, modern psychology has borrowed hugely from the past, and you know, cognitive behavioral therapy, we're into thoughts, emotions, bodily sensations and behavior, things like this. It all sounds terribly scientific and technical. But if you look to the old traditions of meditation, the air element was all about thoughts. The water element was all about emotions. The earth element, much more about sort of bodily reactions and doing stuff. And the fire element, very much again about fundamental motivation, energy, goal seeking. The old systems, human beings have always been trying to make sense of human life. And older traditions of meditation, modern systems of psychology actually have more in common than people often realize. But the beauty of the modern systems is that we do have the wonderful engine room of modern science, and we are developing new and wonderful understandings of the mind that were impossible to people a few hundred years ago because they didn't have brain scanners and all this clever kit we've got today. But what they did know and knew deeply is that if you practice certain mental techniques, if you train yourself to connect with the air element, with your thoughts, if you train yourself to connect with the water element, your emotions, if you train yourself to do this systematically, you get better at it. You develop the ability to move around between those different bits of your experience, to not avoid those different bits of your experience. And you also learn to move in and out of these different states of mind. So you can go and explore your thoughts. You can go and explore your desires. You can go and explore your emotions, your body. You can move your psyche between these different dimensions of your experience. And the better you get at that, the more connected you are to the broad base of your experience, the less dissociated you are from your experience. You learn to integrate those different bits of you into a more complete whole. And in the Western meditation system, you're taught to build a temple to facilitate that integration process. And you're trained in systematic exercises to practice building actually what we'd now call the neural pathways into those parts of your brain. So literally by building this inner temple through a meditative process, what you're actually doing is building a more integrated brain. And again, if you come back to the neuroscanners and the modern science, if you look at what happens if people practice cognitive behavioral therapy methods, it changes the brain. You can see the pathways in the brain strengthening, changing. And we've got lovely, beautiful evidence to support this now. Psychotherapy is actually brain surgery. Slightly less messy than doing it with a knife, but it's actually the same. We've got this wonderful thing. We understand the brain, that it is neuroplastic. This concept of neuroplasticity is so important that the brain, all the way through the life cycle, continues to change, to grow, to modify. And depending on what you do with your brain, that's what shapes your brain. And so you can learn to shape your brain in new and exciting ways. And that's what meditation is all about, growing and changing. It's what psychotherapy is all about, growing and changing. And the growing and changing, of course, that's the song path. That's the journey.
Sage words there from Rufus Harrington, Songpath's cognitive behavioural psychotherapist. Join me next time when Rufus and I continue our conversation, discussing his Wiser Mind psychology of integration, the psychological geography of Carl Jung and E.M. Forster, and the surprisingly grounding force of kaleidoscopic perspectives in the practice of walking a labyrinth. In the meantime, stay connected, follow your thread, and keep walking the song path.